Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and I want to welcome everybody to our 10th anniversary show. Who would have thought that On the Commons would have gone for 10 whole years? And to help us celebrate today, I have one of my favorite guests of all time, Professor Evan McKenzie. Evan, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Sue.
You are a multi-talented, multifaceted, you're an attorney, you're a law professor, you're a professor at the University of Illinois in Chicago, you're a blogger, you're an author, you do it all, Evan, and plus you're a phenomenal dad.
Oh, thank you.
you leave me breathless. I sort of look at everything you do and I think, oh, how does he do it all? But you do. You keep all your balls up in the air. And I want to thank you for joining us today and helping us celebrate 10 years. Let's look back on what happened, what's going on. What's the big story in HOAs today?
Well, first, congratulations to you on 10 years of a tremendous set of interviews with everybody imaginable in this field. You really did a great job. No one else has ever done a thing like this, so I think it's a tremendous archive you've got together. But Besides that, the big story is, I think, the what's going on with private communities across the country, homeowner and condominium associations, in this economy, this meltdown that we're experiencing. We're in what looks like potentially quite a lengthy recession. If you look at this one compared with others, this is one of the deepest and longest-lasting recessions this country's had in a long, long time. And condo and homeowner associations are obviously, by all the information we can see, many of them having some very, very tough times right now because of people being foreclosed on by their banks.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, many people are not paying their homeowner or condominium associations because they don't have the money right at the moment. You know, and they stop paying the association before they stop paying other people. So the delinquencies probably worse than they've ever been, at least in recent memory. And the funny thing is, it's not funny, it's terrible, is nobody knows how bad it is. I get calls from journalists, and they'll say, well, do you have data on what percentage of condo and homeowner associations are suffering, what percentage of delinquencies, and what percentage of the units are in foreclosure? And the answer is no. Nobody does. Because we have 50 separate states here, and they all have different ways of keeping track of things, and hardly any of them do any significant oversight of the financial status of homeowner and condominium associations. They have just basically defaulted on this whole sector. They don't want any responsibility for it. Because if anyone said, you know, you should be keeping track of this, and that would imply, well, maybe they should do something with the data once they got it, you know. Maybe they should try to make things better.
Out of sight, out of mind, huh?
Yeah, out of sight, out of mind. They don't want to know. They just want all these volunteers to do all this work for nothing, and they want all these private taxes to be paid and to take care of all these private streets and private lakes and private this and private that, so that they don't have to do it. And it's a huge windfall for state and local governments, but they don't want any responsibility for this at all. They just want the money. And I've got another book coming out on this topic in a few months, and it's about the relationship between these private communities and local governments, which I think is the big issue that we're facing right now. There's, when the recession hit, state and local governments and homeowner and condominium associations and lending institutions all hit really hard times. And so it's like a game of musical chairs where everyone's trying to find a safe place to sit. And unfortunately, I mean, what has been happening here, I think, is that the municipalities are lashing out any conceivable way to raise money.
Yeah.
Suddenly we've got all these red light camera scams going where they're giving people tickets for the most trivial violations, huge tickets.
Yeah.
You know, and now here in the Chicago area, Cook County, which is desperate for money, is putting red light cameras in municipalities within Cook County. And the municipalities are furious about it. They're saying, we don't want red light cameras in our municipality, in our little city, our suburban city. And Cook County says, well, that's too bad. This is a county road. we're going to do it anyway. So, you know, this is really becoming a desperate grab for money by a whole lot of institutions. And I don't think, personally, that homeowner and condominium associations are in a very good position. And that is why what you see again and again is when associations are in hard times, who suffers? It's the owners.
Always.
It's always the owners because they're at the bottom of the food chain.
Right.
You've got the federal government, the state governments, the municipalities, the counties, and then you've got the corporate association itself and their attorneys and professionals, and they're all going to do fine. But who's going to suffer? The owners. It's always the same thing. And, you know, that's why I've been saying for years and years, as you know, the weak link in this whole institution is the owners.
That's right.
It's not that there's anything wrong with them. It's that they can't. Too much is being expected of them.
Well, I think they're accepting it, and that's my big beef. They're not saying, you know what, back off, leave us alone, and just get out. You know, we're not going to do it anymore. But fines seems to be the way everybody is trying to balance the budget, whether it's state governments, local municipal governments. I mean, we've got the cops hiding in bushes with radar guns all over the place.
Yeah.
If there's a real crime out there, they are understaffed, underpaid, and they just cannot take care of what they're supposed to be doing. But put them behind a tree with a radar gun, you know, they've got plenty of time to do that. So fines, and associations are also using fines. Oh, we've got a budgetary shortfall. We're going to have to increase the fines.
Right.
And so this is what's happening.
Right, that's what's happening. And the problem we're facing here is that there's been this enormous proliferation of governments. And we had terribly fragmented governments in suburbia anyway, and in many municipalities, with special districts here and there, community college districts, library districts, fire protection districts, and on and on and on and on and on. But now, what has happened with associations is they've become like another form of special district. There's yet another person out there to pick your pocket.
Yeah.
And everyone keeps doing it.
Yeah.
But there's only one set of pockets.
Right. And they're not stopping them.
No.
They're not telling them to go fly a kite.
No, and now, you know, the Obama administration wants another $50 billion.
We'll take it out of petty cash.
Well, you know, what they're doing here, it's like the old libertarian joke that basically what they're doing here is taking a big bucket of water. What they're proposing is to take a big bucket of water out of the deep end of the pool and pour it into the shallow end of the pool. I mean, where would this money come from? It's coming from the taxpayers.
Yeah.
Why do people think that this is at some point, you know, generating new wealth? They're just taking it.
I know.
We have to pay it off in this generation or the next generation. I mean, there's just been so much, I think, recklessness in the past about, particularly about condo and homeowner associations and all the other private mechanisms for funding local governments, with little thought for how this was all going to look in the future. I mean, this has been going on now for 30, 40 years. First, we had there was a wave of limitations placed on local government borrowing capability, debt limitations. And immediately, local governments tried to circumvent that by creating all these special districts,
mm-hmm.
And so forth. And then we had the huge property tax rebellion with Prop 13 and so forth starting in 1978, where they started putting all these limits on the ability to raise property taxes. So what do they do then? Well, then they start going to homeowner and condominium associations and other forms of special districts as well, and circumventing this and going to fees and free fees for services so that you don't get the same thing you used to get when you pay the property tax to the school district. You still have to pay for all sorts of things in cash if your kids want band and choir and this and that. They charge you for everything. They just add the same thing with park districts. They're just charging you for everything. Nothing's free.
Yeah.
Well, you know, how long can this go on? I mean, and that's why I think, I hate to say this, but I don't see an economic recovery in the foreseeable future, because in order for that to happen, people have to have some money in their pockets that they can spend on things. And right now, I think the taxation burden that we're facing in the present and in the future, and unfortunately in the long term, because of all the government debt, is really troublesome. I mean, it's really troubling. And so that's why the condominium and homeowner association situation, in my mind, can't get better in the near future.
I agree with you. I'm sort of waiting for the whole thing to collapse under its own weight, and I've been doing that for the last 10, 15, 20 years. I think ultimately it will collapse. I don't know when. Maybe the end is nigh.
I talk a lot about this in this book, but there are different ways you can interpret this, different ways you can spin this out. Obviously, one issue is how many individual associations of all types, condo and homeowner associations, are basically insolvent at the moment, or already insolvent. Because, you know, the precursor to institutions going bankrupt or going under is they've really become insolvent. They become like institutional zombies where they're really not, they're not alive in the sense they're not, they're unsustainable. And I really feel that there are a lot of associations in that position, but they're basically unsustainable. I mean, every time I go on a radio show or talk with people about this or something, someone tells me these stories about their association or the one down the street where people, you know, it's being sustained by a small number of people. It's basically artificial.
Yeah.
I mean, look, if you don't have the vast majority of the units owned by people who live there, the vast majority owned by people who are living there and who are paying assessments, that association is in serious trouble. And I think there are is an enormous number of associations that are kind of limping along like this. And one more shock and they go under. They could go under. What's the alternative? Well, the owners. The owners get hit with some huge special assessment to bail out the association.
Which they can't afford, so they lose the house to foreclosure.
Some people lose the houses. Others lose a huge chunk of their future because their money's gone and they're throwing it into this housing unit. And it can be, this is a devastating recession for these associations, in my opinion. And you've seen the news stories. I put a lot of them on my weblog. There's been dozens and dozens and dozens of feature articles about this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's give the URL for your blogger. And I do want to talk about the book. And we'll come back and talk about the future of HOAs. We've sort of touched on just one of the big problems. There are others. But give us the URL for your blog, Evan.
It's privatopia.blogspot.com.
Lots of good stuff on there, folks. Check it out. And your book. I'm excited about your book, and you're going to have to promise on the air to come back and talk about it when it's out.
I'll be happy to.
All right. What's it called?
Well, right now, the working title right now, I could change it, but it's in copy editing right now, so it'll come out in the fall. It's just Private Communities and Local Governments. And there, I'm trying to, what I did here was, it's published by the Urban Institute, by the way.
Okay.
And what I did in this one is I tried to focus specifically on the relationship that is taking shape between these private communities and all forms of local government. How do they fit into the intergovernmental system? And I try to talk about all the different theories that have been advanced in many different articles and books about what that relationship might be. So I try to describe all the different theories about it, and then to say what I think is happening, which one of these theories makes the most sense to me. And, you know, there's been a lot of the leading target, I guess, that I try to address here is the libertarian view that you see in Bob Nelson's book called Private Neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred Folvary's book and the book by Beto, Gordon, and Tabarrok, The Voluntary City, the people who are really coming out of the neoclassical economics perspective, the people who think that these private associations are superior, a superior form of delivering goods and services to neighborhoods because they are what they call club economies. And I try to trace this whole way of thinking into two sources. One is neoclassical economics, and the other is, and particularly rational choice theory or public choice theory. And then the other is libertarian moral philosophy, where they say not only is this more efficient, which is what the rational choice people say, they focus on efficiency, and they believe that market mechanisms are better than command and control economies. In other words, pricing a service is better than taxing for a service, because if, in their theory, a lot of people get together and voluntarily agree to pool their resources and buy a service, then that's better than the municipality deciding how much everybody needs and then taxing them for it. That's the rational choice theory. Of course, that's not what happens with associations. The problem with this whole paradigm is it's a nice theory, but this is not the way the world really works.
That's right.
And then there's the libertarian moral philosophy, the idea of voluntarism, and that, you know, these are supposedly voluntary communities where people have decided to pool their resources, and therefore it has this moral gloss of contract over it. This is a contract. This is a contractual arrangement. And, you know, they just as soon have people contract themselves into slavery. They don't see anything morally wrong with that either.
But you agreed, right?
What's that?
You agreed.
Agreed with what?
to join this association.
Oh yes, exactly. Yeah, that's the whole logic of this.
Yeah, now, you agreed.
It's all theoretically. I suppose if we lived in a world where all these things were true, I guess you could make a pretty good case for it. But none of the facts that they predicate these models on actually exist. And I mean, people do not set these communities up. Developers do.
Right.
And the people do not have any better information on the pricing of goods and services. The whole thing is bundled and dumped on top of them, and they acquire the rules, and they can't even change them. It's almost impossible to change these rules. It's just exactly the opposite of everything they say. So what I did, I've gotten so tired of having to argue this point that in this book I take every single element of the rational choice and libertarian argument, every single issue, and talk about all of them and whether these conditions prevail or not. And their view that municipalities are going to eventually be replaced by homeowner and condominium associations is one of the models that you see the most out there. You know, that it's a superior way of doing things. And what I try to show is that, because this is what I think. I think that these associations are turning out not to be alternatives to local government at all.
They're not.
They are an addition
right.
to local government. They are increasing the amount of local governance that we have in this country. It is an additional layer of government. And it is a layer that is out of control in large part right now. And the only control being exerted over it, of course, is that they've got these, they're being, to some extent, you know, they're advised and controlled by attorneys and property managers.
Mm-hmm.
But local governments are just taking the money.
Yes.
They're just taking these tax payments and washing their hands of the whole situation. And I don't think this is a sustainable situation. I don't think this is an equilibrium, in other words, that can last for a long time. There are too many problems here. But I do think that's the direction we're going in. We're going in the direction of these associations being built in as some kind of semi-permanent part of the local government system because they're ultimately producing revenue that they're not. It's not revenue from the association to the municipality. It's revenue from the owners to the municipality, and they're funding the association as well that keeps them in this situation.
There's something else that they're doing, Evan. I mean, you have the layers. You have the CDDs, and they have the, you know, another layer above the CDD before you get to the local, real governmental jurisdiction. But what they're doing here in Fairfax County is they're mandating that developers try out new products before the county uses it, but it has to be tried out in an association. So, Mr. Developer, you're going to build this development. We understand there's a new product out there that we're not sure is going to work. We don't want to put our money into it, but you know what, Mr. Developer? We want you to use it, and mm-hmm. we will keep an eye on how well it holds up before we decide to put our money. I mean, it's their money. It's not the taxpayers' money. It's their money.
Yeah.
And again, it goes back to what you were talking about earlier. It's always the homeowner.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if the product fails, and we're talking about infrastructure type of stuff here, so it's big bucks. If the product fails, the homeowners have got to pay for it. Regardless of who tries it.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't see it that way. It's like, our money, we're not going to do it. You do it and let the homeowners pay for it.
Right. Well, you know, what has happened here, if you think about it, is that these homeowner and condominium associations they serve all kinds of purposes. But the libertarians are always telling us that they're serving the purposes of the owners.
No.
But that's exactly the opposite of the real situation. The truth is they're serving the purposes of larger institutions.
Right.
And they're doing things to the owners. They're controlling the owners. You know, one of the biggest fears that governments always have is unregulated collective action by owners. If you're in China, you can't even have a meeting of more than, I think it's 20 people, without a government permit because they're so terrified of collective government action. And the same thing goes in this country. The governments are always afraid of unregulated collective action, which is why they're always telling us how important voting is. Because voting is basically not collective action. Voting is we all toddle off individually, not even talking to each other, and cast a vote on a certain predictable day when the government knows the election is happening and regulates the election to death to make sure that nothing disruptive can happen. And that's the way, you know, elections are really the least disruptive form of political participation, and that's why governments like it so much.
At least on the surface.
Yeah.
On the surface. When you get into the reality of what happens, then, you know, we're finding ballots in people's cars that are cast for certain people.
But oh, sure. But what I mean is elections really don't disrupt government very much.
That's true.
And the it's a regulated form of collective action. And that's what, to me, that's what condo and homeowner associations are. It is a tightly regulated form of collective action. They corral you into a group, and potentially that could be significant. I mean, if all the owners really did get together and really did act like a functioning local democracy, they could really do all kinds of things if they wanted to. But the structure of the association is very carefully set up so that they are constrained. Their lawyers will tell them, no, wait a minute. This is a nonprofit corporation. You can only do certain things. And you have to do them a certain way.
Right.
And the owner and the directors have all the power. It's all top down. So it turns out that this collective that you're in of people is actually a bunch of relatively powerless individuals who can't do anything except wander off and cast a vote once in a while for their board of directors. And the rest of the time, they're just mushrooms.
Well, what I'm hearing from some people, in one case, a woman called me up and said that she had asked questions, she'd gone to the board meeting, the annual meeting, had actually requested information, and the next thing she knew was the management company was outside her house taking pictures while she was in the yard with her kids, and she went up to find out who they were and what they wanted, and they ran over her.
They ran over her?
They ran over her foot.
Good grief.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's physical violence. People's pets have been shot. You know, it's just unbelievable.
Well, I was just out at a development, a condo development in the Chicago area recently because of a client of someone who wants me to assist him with some, but the problem that he has with the association invited me to come out. By the way, this is someone who has already won his lawsuit.
Okay.
He's actually won his lawsuit against his association, but he knows that even though he's won, he can't trust them to implement the ruling accurately. He'll have to follow them every step of the way. So in any event, I just went out there to have lunch and look around and look at the property. And as soon as we get out doors, here come two people from the association wanting to know what's going on and taking my picture.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, so you can't even walk in. It's like something you would see in maybe where Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia. People think these things don't go on, but we know they go on every day in condo and homeowner associations.
Oh, yeah.
These people who have no idea how to use power at all, no idea that they won't even accept limits on their power. They don't know what the law requires of them, these directors.
I know.
They go by what some lawyer tells them to do, which the lawyer tells them to do only because he or she knows they can get away with it. Because the only recourse you have is some civil suit. Here in Illinois, we don't have an ombudsman. Most of the states don't. There's nowhere for owners to turn. So if the lawyer tells them, oh, just jack them around, you know, who cares what the rules are? Who cares what the law says? It doesn't make any difference. The transaction costs of enforcing an owner's rights are so great that they are hardly ever able to do it.
We do have an ombudsman in Virginia, and I still get calls from people who have called the ombudsman, and the ombudsman's hands are tied. The ombudsman's responsibilities are to explain where they can go to get answers. They can look in their governing documents or they can look at the law. They'll give them a copy of the millions of miles of laws that have been enacted empowering associations, and the homeowner's screwed. So,
yeah, because there's nowhere to enforce them.
Well, the ombudsman's not supposed to enforce
right.
it. I mean, she's been there for 2 years. I don't know of a single case that she's ever done. I've tried to get her to come on the show and talk to us, and so far I haven't been able to do that. And then I get people calling me up, and my question is, we do have an ombudsman. Have you contacted the ombudsman? And virtually everyone has said, yes, that's where I started, and she's totally useless. So, I mean, there you go. There's more money that the homeowners are throwing out for some alleged oversight, and we're not getting it.
Yeah.
We're not getting it. The ombudsman in Nevada, the first one, that failed because the idea was not to protect the owners. The idea was to provide a placebo. The idea was to get more money, to enlarge a certain government agency, whatever agency it happens to come under.
You know, one of the projects that I have in mind undertaking here, and now this book is done, is to study what actually happened with the ombudsman offices, how they were structured, and, you know, to get as much data as I can regarding what they've actually accomplished.
Nothing.
But, I mean, it's an idea that potentially has promise, but if you're going to have legal obligations imposed on associations, and if there's no easy way for the owners to make sure that the associations follow the law, lived up to their governing documents and so forth, if there's no convenient way to do it, I don't see what good laws and ombudsman offices do.
They don't. That's been my point. In fact, when the first time they proposed an ombudsman in Virginia years ago, I went down to Richmond and testified against it because what the original law was very good. Senator Bill Mims had proposed a good law that would actually give some kind of protection. But by the time the CAI lobbyists got through with it, it had been watered down to nothing. And what I did was I just went down with a non sequitur cartoon, and it was a picture of this guy who had trudged through the desert carrying a gas can, obviously had run out of gas, ended up in this mirage with an information booth there, and the woman says, "I'm sorry, sir, I'm only authorized to tell you that you're screwed." And I said, "That's the ombudsman." So, I mean, I handed out a cartoon, and I said, "Don't do it. Don't insult us. Don't waste our money. Don't do it." And they did it anyway. They didn't listen to me. I thought if I took a cartoon, that would just really, really excite them. But no.
Well, you know, what we really need more than anything else is, at the start, is information.
Mm-hmm.
And as it stands right now, the industry controls the flow of information. It's entirely privatized. There's
right.
no place to go. There's no government source of information on a national basis. You have spotty data being collected in a few states. And this is just such an unsatisfactory situation. It's such an abdication of government responsibility at all levels.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the federal government has been promoting private communities since about 1961.
Yes.
And, for them to continue to do this, for now, 50 years and almost, and state and local governments, local governments particularly, just profiting like crazy from them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just cash cows. And for the all these levels of government to just turn a blind eye to collecting basic information so that anyone, private or public, could just verify the size, the scope, the numbers, the money, the number of complaints, the number of et cetera, just to keep basic data. So that you can have intelligent legislation. But now when they legislate, it's all industry. It's just a parade of industry people.
It is.
Every state legislature does the same thing. It's just a parade of the same industry faces in state after state after state. And then, of course, they do allow owners to testify.
Sometimes.
But they put them in such a position that, you know, anyone who could, they put them in a position where they're really defenseless. Have them talk anecdotally about one thing that happened here and one thing that happened there. And, of course, the industry people, the big picture is all given by the same people everywhere.
Yeah.
These industry
yeah.
people have this polished routine that they've done.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't want to hear from anyone. And there's not. It's not just me. There are other people who could talk about this. But they don't want to hear from us at all.
Oh, I know that. I went down to testify a couple of years, last year, 2 years ago. And the committee, we went to a committee hearing, and the committee chairman he knew we were there, and I had said that I wanted to talk about it, and there was no requirement to sign up. And they put every bill up before the one that we wanted to talk about, thinking that we would leave and take the 2.5-hour trip back home. And then they put it to a vote and voted on it before they opened it up to the floor. I mean, they always ask any comments. And so I walked up, I just got up and walked down to the lectern, and I said, excuse me, I had a comment. And he says, oh, well, hurry up and get it over with. And so, he was obnoxious. I mean, he glared at me. Frank and I went down and we have this thing. I go first because then Frank listens to what they ask me and he can flip through and find what they want so that he can then come in and just hammer it in. And so I went up and I just stood there. He's glaring at me and he says, give me a line in, line out. And so I start going through that and he says, we don't have that anymore. We just voted on another bill. And they hadn't even made that available. They had not even made that available. So Frank then came in and he says, oh, do we have more people who want to talk about this? And Frank said, well, I can give you a line in and line out, because in the meantime, he had got a copy of the fresh bill. But I hear from people in Houston, I hear from people in Florida, I hear from people in Arizona. They don't want to hear from the homeowners. They just block them out.
No, they don't. I agree. American legislatures are notoriously responsive to organized interest groups.
Money.
Right, and the industry has the money. And they have the numbers, and they have the professional lobbyists, and they control the flow of information, and they have managed to paint the owners into this corner where they end up being very frustrated and being portrayed as angry and disruptive. And, you know, by the time they get a chance to talk, anyone would feel angry and disruptive at that point, you know?
It's our money. Again, you know, here's where the homeowners come at the bottom of the food chain, because it's the homeowner money that's feeding the industry.
Well, you know, what we have to do somehow, what needs to happen is obviously, the owners have to get themselves organized at the same level, at the national level, and they also have to marshal information, and they have to have money, and they have to have the ability to make campaign contributions, to sponsor research. I mean, if the owners don't have a parallel structure to counter the things that come from CAI and some other industry organizations, then the only voices that get heard are those of the professionals.
The thing is,
that's the way it is right now.
Homeowners don't have any money. It's the professionals that have taken it, the associations that have taken it, the governments that have taken it.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, the owners, you know, there are so many owners. Think about it.
No, I know.
We're talking about probably at least 30 million owners here.
Yeah, no, I know.
There's lots of money out there.
Yeah, $1.
If they all gave a dollar, you could have a $30 million organization. It would dwarf CAI.
That's true.
But, you know, you can't even get people to join. And the problem is, it's the problem Ansar Olson talked about, the famous economist, the collective action problem. Producer interests always get organized, and consumer interests hardly ever do, because the producers are small in number. There's just a few of them. And each one of them has a huge stake, a huge economic stake. And it makes perfect economic sense for each one of them as an individual to contribute to the group effort, because they get more out of it than they put in. Before the individual owner, the situation is reversed. Oh, collectively, their stake is gigantic. But for each one of them, it's relatively small. And nobody wants to be, you know, the one who contributes far in excess of what they actually get. And that's why you end up with so many people who say, well, they're interested in these issues up until their problem is solved one way or another.
Right.
And they're not interested anymore. Because they, like the producers, were motivated by their own individual concerns.
Right.
The problem is their individual concern isn't that big, and it's temporary. The producers, these people are, this is a 30-year career for them.
Well, I think that's the difference as well. I mean, most homeowners have other jobs. They're doctors, they're lawyers,
right.
They're bus drivers, they're street sweepers. You know, it doesn't matter what they do. It's not, you know, it's not their career. These people, it's their career.
Yep.
You know, when they go home, they can go and play basketball with their kids or go to the movies or just kick back and relax. Yet the homeowner comes home, is scared to death of going to the mailbox, and then has to get organized to fight to keep their homes intact. I mean, this is an invasion of private property.
Mm-hmm.
This is an invasion of your home. When you have to get permission to put a hose out, when you're sued because for $1 million because you have a blog, And you're telling people what's going on at the meetings?
Well, you know...
You get run over?
I was just... last week, I'm on a doctoral dissertation committee for a UIC graduate student who just finished his dissertation. Very good dissertation about the Kelo decision.
Ah.
Which I know we've talked about before.
Yes.
And we were talking about this. I mean, his concern it relates to some of the things we've been talking about. He focused on the legislation that passed after the Kelo decision. And the Kelo versus, for those people who don't know, the Kelo versus City of New London decision was a Supreme Court ruling from 2005.
Yeah.
That said, that cities can use eminent domain to take property for economic reasons, to increase tax revenues and spur economic development. And despite the fact that the Fifth Amendment says public property should not be taken for a public use without just compensation, it said public use.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Kelo decision says that public benefits, public interest,
purpose, I think was the word.
Can justify a taking even if it's not being put to a public use in the sense of being public property.
Yeah.
So you can take the property from a neighborhood of people like Suzette Kelo and give it to Pfizer Corporation or
mm-hmm.
something. Well, in the wake of that, and there were so many people angry about the implications for private property rights, that practically every state in the country, the legislature drafted some kind of a reform to their eminent domain proceedings, you know, to try to supposedly protect the owners. And almost everywhere,
yeah.
The legislatures claimed that they had now cured the problem created by the Kelo decision.
Yeah.
And what Tom Kelly showed in his dissertation is, it's all false.
It is.
It is almost universally the case that there were more takings
mm-hmm.
after the reform legislation than there were before. This, in other words, the legislation is basically just smoke and mirrors. It's feel-good stuff. It isn't really effective in preventing these takings for economic purposes. It isn't effective at all. And that's the shell game that these legislatures are constantly
yeah.
playing. You know, they pass a law, and it goes on with condo and homeowner association legislation. It's a perfect example.
Oh, yeah.
They do it all the time. They give you the impression, they have
yeah.
the fanfare, that they've cured this problem or fixed that problem. In reality, they haven't.
I've asked them to deregulate HOAs, and they think I'm crazy. We were better off before we had all these laws, Evan.
You think so?
Yeah. I do. Because I think a lot of the laws, all the laws were written by CAI as like a puzzle, a jigsaw puzzle. They came in with one piece at a time. Nobody saw the big picture. And, you know, now when they've put enough pieces in there and you're beginning to see the picture, we were better off. I mean, people won their lawsuits beforehand. Associations didn't have the power to fine and foreclose. You know, they just didn't have those powers before.
So from your standpoint, you think all this legislation is actually just a three-card Monte game and that it's made the situation ultimately worse. You think you're winning something, but actually the card that you think is the Red Queen actually isn't.
It's what it's done is empowered associations
yeah.
and ultimately empowered CAI lawyers. It's just given them another means of getting into your pocket. I mean, think about it. Look at all the legislation that's been enacted.
No, I've definitely thought about this. I'm not sure whether that it's the case in all. I think there's some legislation that's quite beneficial, but I do understand your picture that if there were none at all, things would have resolved themselves in a different way.
I mean, now you've got all of these burdens that are added to the homeowners and all of the powers that have been given to associations because, gosh, these poor volunteer board members need to be able to do their jobs, you know. And if they can't do their jobs, who wins? I mean, you go after someone because they're 10 cents behind. I've heard of one woman losing her house because she was 4 pennies in arrears. 4 cents.
Really?
Yes. This was an old lady. Home was paid for and off she, you know, they went and foreclosed on her. For 4 pennies. And guess how much the attorneys got?
Probably quite a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. So 80-year-old ladies out in the streets. But, you know, there are bullies all over the place. You were talking about the Kelo decision, and although, and Carla Main wrote a book about called Bulldozed. And one of the guys in Texas, and I can't think of his name, who was the bad guy, the developer, threatened to sue her when the book came out because she painted him in a bad light.
Well, you know, we're
we're a little beyond HOAs right now.
You know, well, part of what's I keep thinking that associations are part of something larger. It's just there's a bigger picture here.
There is.
I've always felt that way, that this is one part of a much bigger picture. And the challenge has always been to figure out what that larger picture is, because it's not obvious. And, you know, I thought at one time, back in the early 90s, it seemed as though associations and municipalities were going to be at odds with each other, because particularly I was working in Pennsylvania at the time, and during the late 80s and early 90s, there was a real conflict in New Jersey between the League of Municipalities and the Common Interest Association lobbyists, CAI, over the Municipal Services Act and other issues. But basically, in New Jersey, the state took some steps to equalize the tax burden, to do something about the double taxation problem. And boy, when they did that, you know, there was some real conflict. And because now there's a conflict over money. But if you take away that conflict, then why should there be any conflict between municipalities and HOAs? Why should the cities object to having more and more and more of them, you know? And then just in exchange for getting their property, full property tax checks from all these people, while not having to deliver services to them, just say, oh, well, go ahead, and you handle things however you want in there. We'll pretend that you're all just a bunch of good-hearted community volunteers doing the best you can, and we'll just sort of let you do whatever you want. And we'll just say, well, all the neighbors agreed to have you do whatever you wanted, and sort it out among yourselves.
Well, you know, CAI was going around talking to local municipal government. This was when they were trying to show that they were actually working for the homeowners. And they were getting local municipalities to kick some money back to condominiums for trash removal. In the process, they agreed that if they would pick up, you know, kick back some money or pick up the trash or whatever it was, that they would never, ever, ever come back and ask for anything else. And so now you've got another contractual agreement between the association and the local municipal government. You know, we're going to chuck a couple of bucks at you to pick up your trash. And, you know, you can't come back to us for anything else. You promised. It's right here.
Yes.
Yes. And who's at the bottom of the food chain, Evan?
Oh, exactly.
You know?
Well, you know, one of my favorite singers is Tom Waits, the kind of eccentric singer-songwriter. I think he's the greatest. And he's got a song called Step Right Up, which is about advertising. And he's got a great line in it. It says, "The large print giveth, and the small print taketh away."
Absolutely.
And that's the situation the owners are in. They bought the large print and all those advertising brochures and all those beautiful pictures and that's all the large print. All the stuff you're going to get, you know, the carefree, maintenance-free living, the wonderful amenities. That's all the large print. The small print is the CC&Rs, the governing documents. And that's where you find out what you gave away.
Well, it's, you know, you don't even find out what you gave away because they keep coming back later. I mean, there's that little clause that says you can amend the governing documents and you agree to whatever somebody says in the future.
I agree with you, but you know what's scary about this is it's not amending the documents that's the problem.
No.
Because the truth is, it's very hard to amend these declarations. It's very hard. The problem is that you see courts and state legislatures giving the directors the power to make rules. I mean, here in Illinois, they can deprive you of your right to rent your unit or to have pets, even if your declaration says you have those powers, those authorities.
Yeah.
They can pass a rule that takes away your rights by a vote of a majority of the board of directors.
But they're not supposed to do that because the only jurisdiction boards have is over the use of the common area.
Well, so yes, what they'll say is, yeah, but we have the right to make operating rules. And so they make operating rules that actually infringe on things you should have the right to do by virtue of your declaration, but they just call it an operating rule.
Well, now what CAI is trying to do, and they're trying to get it passed across the states, in all the states, is empowering courts to allow board members. If a board, let's say that a board decides that they need a certain power or they need to be able to get rid of or add or something, and they have to do it by amending the CCNRs.
Mm-hmm.
So they put it to a vote of the homeowners, and the homeowners vote no. They attempt to put it to a vote, even if it doesn't ever go to a vote.
It doesn't have a quorum.
It's, you know, you've got to attempt three times, and if the homeowners say no three times, you can go to court and
right.
have the judge overrule that decision
right.
and
right.
give you the, you know. So small print's useless.
Yeah, well, I know. And this where this started, that approach started, was with something that was actually a good thing, which was the removal of race-restrictive covenants from declarations. About, I don't know, 8 or 9, 10 years ago, there was a whole series of news articles about this. It's something I've been talking about for years, but which was that there are loads and loads of old associations that have race-restrictive covenants in them, that you can't sell your house to an African-American or something like that.
Right.
In fact, almost all the places that were started before, say, 1950, 1955, even 1960, almost all of them had those restrictions in them. And so when they'd go off to court and they'd be embarrassed by the discovery of this thing. And, I mean, the one Byron Hankey lived in, he had a place in Chesapeake Bay, I think it was called Scientist Cliffs or something like that. It was
yeah.
a summer home. And he told me, you know, this is embarrassing. He said, gee, you know, the place we live still has a race-restrictive covenant on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it's one of these things that you can't get rid of unless you can get a two-thirds majority of all owners, and you can't even get them all to vote. So how the heck do you get rid of these things? Well, there was a whole series of news articles about this. New York Times and a bunch of other mm-hmm. places did pieces on this. And that was when several states started with this idea of, well, why don't we have a judicial override power here? Why don't we set it up so that if you have some crazy piece of, you know, a blue law type of a thing, some crazy old thing, like a race-restrictive covenant, that obviously needs to go. Well, if you can't get a quorum for the meeting, you can't get the two-thirds vote, well, we'll just give the judge the power to get rid of it. Well, if you're talking about racial discrimination, hey, great. Any way you can get that out of there is fine, as far as I'm concerned. But the problem is, once you get the camel's nose under the tent and have judges rewriting these declarations, that's going to be a big problem. You really, that is, has to be a real problem, because judges believe in authority. You know, they believe everybody should follow rules. That's what they do. I'm not saying they're a bunch of Nazis, not anything but, they're not at all that way. But they do think that rules are important. That's why they became judges. We all need more rules. You can't have too many people following rules, you know? And when somebody comes in there, when the lawyer paid by the association comes in and says, look, we need this rule. We need to ban renters. We need to ban pets. We need to do this or that with the parking. We need to do this or that with collections. We need to restrict the owners in this way or that way. Judges are very, very susceptible to that these days. We don't have the kind of judiciary we had in the 60s where they were all concerned about individual rights. You know, judges these days overwhelmingly see the needs of the group to be regulated before they start thinking about the right of the individual to be free.
I was under the impression that the racial restrictions are
law. They've been unenforceable since 1948, but the point is they were just an embarrassment. That's the reason why having the court judges remove them was was perfectly okay because they weren't enforceable anyway. It was just an embarrassing, almost defamatory sort of thing. You know, you'd move into a development and people would look at their covenants and say, oh my God, look what's in here. You know?
Okay, I thought, you know, they can take away, but they can't add to it. It's when they add to it that I have a problem. But
yeah.
Byron Hankey had some other problems. He was not allowed to put up the type of siding or, you know, on the house that he built over there. He wanted a blue house when all the other houses in the development were brown. So he didn't have anything on his house. It was a beautiful house. I went there, but...
Oh, really?
Yeah. The year before he died, I went to a summit there.
Wow.
Really,
fantastic.
Yeah, it was really gorgeous. And he took me to his bathroom, and he says, see, I stand here and I shave, and I can look in the mirror, a huge mirror, and he says, and I can see the babe, you know, behind me. It's awesome. It's really gorgeous.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So, but for years, he was not allowed to put up his blue siding.
Well, I'm surprised he didn't become an association rebel.
He said, can you believe how ridiculous these people are?
Yes, I know.
No,
well,
I wouldn't have dawned on
me. It's one of the things he said when I asked him about this, this question of the two-thirds supermajority for amending declarations. I said, where did that come from? I mean, whose idea was this? And why did you decide that when he was the head of the land planning division of FHA, why did you figure that it had to be in every declaration if you wanted mortgage insurance? And he kind of laughed. And he said, well, back then we were thinking that the biggest problem was all these crazy owners. And
yeah.
He kind of laughed.
Yeah, that was the
And now he's seen, you know, after all these years, he'd seen some of the crazy things the directors did.
Well, he was not very happy with CAI. In fact, he told them that they needed to be a lot more open and work more with the homeowners.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, after he died, they shut down. I mean, with Tom Skiba and Frank Rathman, everything's been shut down tight. They sort of built this huge wall around themselves. I think.
Well, CAI became, in the early 90s, became a full-blown trade association.
Yeah.
It was intended at the outset, as Byron Hankey and Link Cummings and others intended, it was supposed to have been a real institute.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be a place that represented the owners, the developers, the
right.
professionals, the government officials, the academics, and everybody. And we would all meet together to kind of solve problems and make the institution work and make it better. And about 20 years after it was formed, it just became a full-blown trade association. And that's what it is. It's just like the Tobacco Institute or the American Bar Association or something. It's a flat-out trade association. And, you know, as I keep saying, there's nothing wrong with having a trade association.
That's right.
It's perfectly okay for these professionals to have an association. They should have one. But don't run around pretending that you are what it started out to be, that this is some sort of an institute that cares about everybody and wants everyone to get along and represents owners. Just don't, you know, quit lying about it. That's the problem, is when they keep insisting it's something other than a trade association for lawyers and property managers.
Evan, we're out of time, and I'm so sorry that we're out of time because I'm just loving this discussion. But thank you so much.
My pleasure, Shu, and congratulations on 10 great years.
I know, isn't it fascinating? I always thought at the beginning that I would never know, you know, I would never be able to fill a 6-month contract. And here we are 10 years later, and I just don't know which stories to cover because there's so much going on.
Time to put your book out.
Yeah, I agree with you. Thank you for joining us today. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos. Someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.